How do I define leadership?
Confidence without ego.
I never expected things to happen if you didn't work every single day at them.
Hi, podcast listeners. I'm Lillian Cunningham, the editor of On Leadership at The Washington Post. Each week, we talk to influential people about their lives and careers and the lessons they learned along the way. This week, I'm with David Sedaris, the author and great American humorist. One of the common themes for this series for us is asking people what they feel like were big influencers on their character. And you obviously write a lot and talk about your family and the effect that they've had on you. Do you feel like that's been the biggest shaper of your character? Are there other things you would point to as really pivotal moments or people in your life that made you?
Well, like my father. You know, one thing you can say about my father is that he's not a hypocrite, you know? Like, my father didn't want us to smoke, so he quit smoking, right? And my father is the most disciplined person probably that I've ever known. And he would get up in the morning and he would do these, we would laugh at him. He would get up and do these little exercises in his underpants in the living room, but did them every single morning. And I don't know if you can inherit discipline, but I never expected things to happen if you didn't work every single day at them, you know. I think, too, perhaps from going to art school and kind of being around artsy people before then, you know, you start noticing a lot of how many people just talk about being an artist of one sort or another, but you never see them actually doing anything. All they do is talk about it. And I think that those people made me think more about my dad and, you know, that it was just better not to talk about it and just to go into a room and do it. Someone said a while ago, you should always marry your conscience, right? And Hugh and I, my boyfriend, we've been together for 23 years and we're not married and I would never marry him. But, so I didn't marry my conscience, but I live with him. You know, he was a really decent person in ways that it can be really, really irritating. And I always have him on my shoulder. And I'm grateful for it, though, because Hugh's not the kind of person who would say, oh, it's okay to cheat, or everybody steals a little something sometimes, or so what if you hurt that person's feelings? They had it coming, you know? I was on a plane, and they put me in first class on this flight from Atlanta to Raleigh. But it was a bigger plane than I expected. Huge plane, like you would take to Europe. And so first class and coach were separated by a galley, right? And we land in Raleigh, and as we're taxiing to the gate, the flight attendant made an announcement and said, we have some very special people on board. And I thought, oh, don't embarrass me. And then she... And then I'm wondering who the other special person is, because she said people. And she said, with us today is the outstanding high school soccer team from, and she named the soccer team. Let's give them all a great big hand. And the woman behind me applauded, and nobody else did. And she said, you people are assholes. You're so caught up in your smartphones and your iPads. You can't even clap for a bunch of teenagers. And I told Hugh about it when I got off the plane. And he said, she's completely right. You should have clapped. I said, well, they were in coach. I said, they wouldn't have heard me anyway. And he said it didn't matter and I should have done it. And, you know, you want to say sometimes, like, well, you weren't there. It was different if you were there. But, you know, again, of course he was right. It wouldn't have killed me to applaud for. I just kind of let down because I thought I was a special person on board.
How would you define leadership? Do you think about that term at all?
You know, what's interesting, I've had a couple leaders in my life, right? Once, when I lived in Raleigh, North Carolina, I fell in with a group of conceptual artists. Right, and we did a performance piece. And no one had heard of a performance piece in Raleigh, North Carolina at that time. So we took over an abandoned tobacco warehouse. And we spent like 2 months cleaning it up. And our leader was the fellow who wrote the show that we performed. And I never asked him what it meant. I have no idea what it meant. I have no idea what it was about. I have no idea what my lines meant, right? But I was very grateful for the attention, and I was grateful that someone had confidence in me. And you know, our friends and family came to the show, and everybody said, that was a waste of time, or that was the most boring thing I've ever seen in my life. And it made the group tighter because you thought, they don't understand, you know? We're alone. And then the leader announced that we were going to do another show, and it was going to be a group effort, right? And so he assigned us each colors. So I was Mr. Green. And one day I opened my door, and there's an envelope that says Mr. Green, and it in their instructions for me to go to a corner and to wait for a certain bus and to take the bus to a hospital and to go into a room at the hospital where this woman's going to be waiting for me. And I go to the hospital, and it's a, I don't remember what disease this woman had, but she said, oh, I was told you were going to be here, right? So our leader did that to everyone in the group. And he invited us to take that experience and write something and contribute toward the piece. And nobody had the wherewithal to write something, right? And so we turned on the leader. He's trying to boss us around. He's a control freak. He's, you know, a control freak. What we were basically doing is punishing him for being a leader. And I think leaders often get punished for being the leader because everyone's all for the leader, and then they become maybe envious that they're not that they don't have what it takes to lead. The whole group fell apart, and it ended horribly, right? And I've often thought about that, and I apologized to the leader. I saw him like 20 years later, and I said, you know, I feel awful about the way we treated you, and it didn't have anything to do with you. You were asking us to do something that we all said we could do and we would love to do, but we actually didn't know how to do it. We weren't equipped to do it. And rather than admitting that, we turned on you. But I'm trying to think, you know, I don't do things as a team very often. So I don't have a lot of experience with leaders. I think you recognize one.
Do you think writers can be leaders? Or does that seem like it's not a fitting term?
You know, maybe if you're, I mean, in a literal sense, right? I've led writing workshops when I was teaching, and it's your job to control the room. It's a little bit different, though, because you're the teacher.
What about in relationship to your readers and fans and the way that you lead book readings and host book signings and your interactions with them? Have you thought through it all, what your philosophy is on that and the way that you sort of treat the part of your career that isn't just sitting down and writing something?
God, yes. I put a lot of thought into that. I remember when I first moved to Chicago, there was a bookstore near me called the Unabridged Bookstore. And it was the first time I went to a bookstore where they had actual authors come. I remember I went and saw this author who I was very excited about, and I bought her book, and it was a hardcover book, and it was a lot of money to me at the time. And I waited in line, and I got up there, and she didn't look at me. She didn't talk to me. She was talking to her publicist about what she was going to do for dinner. And I felt so betrayed. I just thought, I believed in you, and this was a lot of money. And I just thought, if it's ever me at that table, things are going to be different. So I is at a Harvard bookstore the night before last, and I signed books for 8 hours and 45 minutes. People were like, well, let me let you go. I keep them so long at the table that they're just desperate to get away from me. I mean, it took that long because I talked to everybody. You know, if I was at a cocktail party and I had to meet people, I would be very nervous. And plus, you're thinking, oh, how do I get away from this person, or is this person going to feel trapped by me? And this is a perfect little relationship. I hand the book back, and then the conversation's over. I would never, ever say to anybody, well, there are a lot of people here, or, well, thanks for coming. There have been a few times when the bookstore has come in and said something to that effect, and I've said, and I get upset then, and I say, don't, I would, you know, that person is probably burning with shame now. I don't ever want to make someone feel that way. Like, that's not how I want to be doing this. When the line is held up and it's somebody who's going on too long, what you kind of want to do is take their book and then throw it across the room and say, go get it. Go get it. And they would probably be relieved because it would be their way out. And people come and they'll say, oh, this must be exhausting. And I always think, why? What would possibly make you think that? It's people standing in line to say how much they love you. It's like all I ever dreamed of. And it's never worn off. It is never worn off. It's the same way as being in The New Yorker, never wears off. You know, you think there's not a single issue of The New Yorker that I'm in. It'll come in the mail, and then I open it on the kitchen table to my page my story's on, and I walk by and I say, wait a minute, is my name in The New Yorker? You know, and I want to be my 20-year-old self stumbling upon this, which, you know, you can never do. But the thrill never dissipates, and I'm genuinely so grateful that people would show up to get a book signed.
We always ask everyone, what do you believe?
What do I believe?
You can interpret it however you want.
Gosh. You know, one thing I've noticed living overseas, it sort of teaches you how American you are. You know, so many people move to France, for example, thinking, I never really fit in the United States. And then they go to France, and if they're aware in any way, they think, oh, my God, I'm really an American. And one of the ways in which I'm really an American, and it took living overseas to realize, is that I really do believe that hard work pays off, and that you can do whatever you want to do. Because if it worked for me, it can really work for anybody. And it's interesting, your chances of improving your social status are better in England than they are in the United States. But British people don't believe it, and American people do believe it. So there's a kind of optimism that I exhibit that is not too common where I live. Now I live in England, right? And I get made fun of a lot for it. But I am a pretty optimistic person, and I think it has to do with being raised to believe that you can do what you want. And if it doesn't work out, you just have yourself to blame. I mean, luck has a lot to do with it, but work has a lot to do with it as well. I believe that shorts, those cargo shorts, are a huge mistake for anyone. I signed a book last night for a man, and I said, you know what today is? He said, what? I said, today's the last day you wear those cargo shorts. I said, cargo shorts tell the world I will wear anything, okay? I believe that skinny jeans are going to be, I think they're laughable now, but I think 10 years, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, anyone who wears a pair of skinny jeans is going to cut the lower half of their picture out, right? If it's a picture of them standing up, they're going to snip off the lower half of that photograph, because skinny jeans are a huge mistake. They don't look good on anybody. I believe that Whoopi Goldberg is much more talented than anyone gives her credit for. I believe that Tobias Wolff is America's greatest short story writer. I believe... I was on a roll for a moment there.
Where do you think your sense of humor comes from? And do you feel like it's gotten better over time with more experience, or humor just doesn't work that way?
You know, it's interesting... I was listening to some James Thurber recently, and it was interesting to me how it had dated. And not all of it. I mean, his writing is so clean, and the rhythm of his sentences, and he's a really elegant writer. But especially in regards to women. Like, the women in his stories are all standing by the door with a rolling pin in their hand, right? And at the time that he was writing, that was the gag, right? And so that's kind of dated, and it doesn't really play anymore. And listening to that, I thought, oh, I wonder how then my work will date as well. I have no idea what people will make of the things that I've written. If I look at books that I wrote a long time ago, I can see myself trying too hard, you know? And it just fills me with shame. You should never let people see you trying. Quite often young people will give me their writing, and I see them doing that, you know? And they're kids, you know, and they'll grow out of it. And I grew out of it, too. The only problem is I had some books that were written before I grew out of it.
What does writing do for you? Does it make you happy? What does it fulfill for you?
I mean, it gives me it defines my mood. It defines my day. I don't know that it's cathartic. I mean, I write in my diary every morning, and nothing quite makes sense to me until I put it on paper. And often I'm ashamed of myself. I read my diary. I'm ashamed of myself. I think, what would I, if anyone ever got their hands on this, what would they make of this person? Right? And the good thing is, you know, that's the beauty of a diary, though, is that it's not for anyone else. So you're not being a phony in it. You're just completely being yourself. So, for better or for worse. And I think it's good in a way to remind yourself that you're that person. You know, you can tell yourself, I've always been this enlightened, and I've always believed this, and I've always... And it's like, no, it's just right there on paper, you know? I said to someone the other day, I don't know what it was, who I was trying to kid. I said, it's not that hard being nice to people. You know, which makes me sound like such a good guy. And then I thought about it later, and I thought, no, it's not that hard to be nice to nice people. You know, it's really hard to be nice to people who aren't nice. That's work right there.
I was reading an old article that you did, I think it was with The Guardian, where you talked about art school and realizing that you probably weren't meant to be an artist because you didn't feel jealous of other people's success there. And I just thought that was a really interesting thought, and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about jealousy being something of an indicator for what you truly care about or not.
Well, I went to art school, and I had some shows before I went to art school. And when I went to school, I just saw that there were people with much more passion than I had. I mean, I would never have gone to school and not done my homework. And I didn't turn in things that I knew were bad, but I just thought, these are people who are investigating art, who are finding things deep inside themselves, and they're going to continue that way. Like, that well is never going to run dry. They're so much more passionate than I am. And I thought, well, somebody has to be their audience. And so it felt so good when I backed down and I could just take myself out of the picture and just be happy and just champion them. And in the way that you can if you're not competing with people, right? And then, right, so then I was competing with writers because I decided, okay. But I have to say, I was never too jealous of writers either. I was pretty much happy for them. You know, like if I found out that somebody got a book deal, or I never wasted much time feeling ill will. I was always told, just work every day, and when the time is right, the publishing will take care of itself. So I worked every day, and then Little Brown called one day and said, do you have a book we can publish? And I said, I've been waiting all my life for your call. It's right here in a drawer. And so it worked out just the way I was told that it was going to work out. That said, you know, I think I was, what, 35 when my first book came out? 37. Now, I'm 57 now. If I had never published a book, I might be kind of bitter now. You know, I might not be so happy for others now. So perhaps it was my own success that allowed me to feel generous towards others. But, you know, when your books do well, there's a guilt, you know, of course, if you feel guilty about it, because there are much better writers than I am. So how is it fair? I don't know why that is. It's not a fair world, I guess. But I'm so happy that it worked out in my favor rather than someone else's, I have to say.
Since you're such a keen observer of the human condition and people's idiosyncrasies, I'd love to ask you what you think makes for a great person, and not necessarily a great, you know, person to put down in a story, but what are some of those things that you notice in people and you just think, like, that makes for a really fantastic person?
I saw some people in Buffalo the other day who I'm just crazy about. I have these three families that I feel like I've adopted them, but I think it's probably the other way around. You know, they're friends of mine who have children, and I feel like if I had children, they would be horrible. But all three of these friends, their children are, it's like when they leave the room, it's like the sun went out. You know, you just absolutely love being around these children, and they're so engaging, and and they get older, and you think, okay, the next time I see them, they're just going to be texting people, and they're going to be answering questions with one word. No, they're consistently engaging and interesting and delightful. And, you know, the parents aren't, you know, they're not those kinds of parents who just say, you're special, and everything you do is special. You know, they have standards. But they have a generosity of spirit and a selflessness, I think, and an enthusiasm. And who wants to be around people who just hate everybody and hate everything? It's just so draining to be around people like that. I like to be around people who like stuff, you know? I'd rather be around a person who likes every stupid TV show that there is, and someone who's decided there's nothing worth watching, and oh, there are no good books written by living authors, you know, all the good ones are dead. And there's enthusiasm and like generosity. And you know, one of these people who I'm so crazy about wears cargo shorts, you know what I mean? But I'm like willing to forgive him even for that. He's just such a great guy. Gosh, I wish I could put my finger on it more. What is it that, you know, being funny doesn't hurt, you know? But these people who I'm talking about, they're not, you know, they're funny enough, but they're not exhaustingly funny, or they don't insist on making everybody laugh all the time. I think being a good listener, I think if you're a straight guy, all right, and let's say you could have volcanic acne, all right, you could have cargo pants, you could smell bad, but if you're a good listener, you won't be alone. That is such a good quality. I'm a good listener, but it's, you know, it's for my own selfish reason. Like, I'm going to go home and I'm going to write about it in my diary. The people I'm talking about are just good listeners just because.
Maybe we'll just end with asking you for your best piece of advice.
That I would give to other people or that I've received?
Oh, you know, I was thinking that you would give to someone else, but it could be that you received.
Advice I give to other people. There are a couple of ways in which I feel perfectly justified telling people what to do. And when I meet young people, one of the things I say is the most important thing, or maybe it's not the most important thing, but a very important thing, is to write thank you letters. People love giving things to people who are grateful. And you put that thank you letter down and you put it on paper and you put a stamp on it and you will get more stuff. It just makes sense. I'm not talking about an email. I'm talking about an actual letter. You sit down and write it. It doesn't take any time at all. And it makes all the difference in the world. So that's advice.
Did you have something in mind for yourself that someone said to you once that stuck with you?
Well, when I think, you know, I think the advice that I received that stuck with me was, when the time is right, things will happen. People will come to you. Because, you know, quite often when I'm signing books, people will come up and they'll give me something they've written, and they'll say, I'd like to get this published. And I don't even need to read it. I know what it's going to be like. These are people with a talent for self-promotion. That's their talent, not writing. You know, people like to find people. People like to do favors for people. And you should give them the opportunity to do that. Right? Like, years ago, I was reading in Chicago, and Ira Glass just happened to be in the audience. And then we shook hands, and then 3 years later, he called and then asked if I had anything Christmassy that might work for a local show that he had called The Wild Room, kind of an early version of This American Life. And I didn't invite Ira to be in the audience that night. I didn't pursue him. It just worked out. He just happened to be there. And this young woman came one night to a reading, and she gave me her manuscript, and she had written on it, "Please, David, you can be my Ira Glass." And I thought, no, it's already too late, because I never asked Ira for anything. I was in Manchester in a bookstore, and there was a young man there who worked at the bookstore, and I don't know, there was just something about him. He was just so curious and odd and funny. And I said, "Do you do something else?" And he said, "Yeah." And he was evasive. And I said, "What else do you do? I don't believe you just work at this bookstore." And he said, "Oh, I write a little bit." And I said, "I would love to see what you write." And I gave him my address, and I said, "Please send me what you've written." And he sent me these stories, and they were unlike anything I'd ever read. They were so original and just so compelling. It was so exciting to read. You got the idea that you were reading something that it must be like, you know, walking down a hallway and hearing Chopin play for the first time, right? This was something. And I wrote him back, and I said, "Whenever you're ready, whenever you would like me to put your writing into people's hands, it would be my great pleasure to do so." That's how it should work. You know, you have to give me a little bit of credit for being observant. And that's what I feel like when people shove stuff at me. It's like, you're not giving me any credit. You're not allowing me to do my thing. You're not trusting me. And so I think that's good advice, too, is don't be so, everybody's so pushy, and everybody wants to, you know, when people say it's all who you know, and I don't believe that. I think that if you just work really hard, I think somehow it shows, and it makes you a certain kind of person, and there are other kinds of people who are a magnet for the kind of person that you are if you're truly creative.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and stay tuned for a new conversation next week. You can also go to washingtonpost.com/leadership to watch our videos and read more stories.